Tansi, and welcome to Pitigwe. Come in. This is a space where stories live, breathe, and connect us. Here we honor the voices of our Métis people, gathering wisdom from the past, celebrating resilience in the present, and shaping a path for the future. Each episode is a thread in the sash, weaving together tales of culture, tradition, and community. So come in, sit with us, and let's share the stories that remind us who we are and where we belong. This is Pitigwe. This is home.
So we're here, day one of the Métis Nation Saskatchewan Legislative Assembly. And with me, I have Mr. Nolan Malboff. How you doing, Nolan?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm excellent, excellent. Have you ever been to an MNLA before, Nolan?
First timer.
Yeah. And what are your expectations of the weekend?
Well, I've learned early on in life that you don't have expectations so they can't be broken. I'm just here checking it out, seeing what's going on. Anytime Métis gather, it makes me excited. And my sister's in town, heard you guys are around, so I'd come check it out.
Nice. Well, welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
So where are you originally from, Nolan?
Originally, I'm from a place called CP Sick. That's Beauval, Saskatchewan, northwest. Yeah.
And how long did you live in CP Sick?
I lived there till I was 21. I moved from there to LaRange. I got my Bachelor of Education degree there in a program called NORTEP. So I lived in LaRange for 4 years, and then I moved back to the west side. I taught 1 year in Buffalo River, that's Dillon. And then from there, I moved to Regina, and I've been here ever since.
Okay. Yeah. And what year did you move to Regina?
Oh, man. 2008, maybe? Yeah, 2008, I believe, when I moved here.
Nice. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your experience at NORTEP in LaRange.
NORTEP was amazing, mostly because it was small. And because it was small, I was able to like build some really meaningful friendships with the other students that were there, people that were like I was familiar with, people from all across that I knew, Buffalo. So it really helped me to feel comfortable there. Originally, I never wanted to be a teacher. I was just
when you taught.
I was trained as a middle years teacher. My first year teaching, I did high school math science, which was a big leap for me. I slept at the school. There was a cot there, so I would like work late, have a snooze if I was tired, and just put in so much work. But it was good work. I feel like I made a positive impact there. Attendance was. We flipped the attendance. I was young, I was passionate and all that. And then when I moved to Regina, I started working for this agency called Ranchero, which works with vulnerable youth, youth that have been apprehended, that are away from home. So my area of expertise kind of shifted, and I went from academic focus to more of building people, you know, and trying to establish hope and value in young people that have not had the greatest experiences. Mm-hmm. So I did that for 14 years. And 2 years ago, I retired to become a full-time tattoo artist. So that's what I'm doing now.
Okay. Yeah. Let's back up a little bit.
Sure.
You mean to tell me that you actually slept on a cot in the school?
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes when I was tired, I'd lay down in the cot and then I'd get up. And because I'll tell you an example, I wasn't good at math in high school. I was actually very bad at school in high school. I was just a wild young guy and wasn't living really that well. But then when I went to university, I built some self-confidence that I didn't know I had. And then math kind of opened up and it really reinforced this idea that if I work hard, I can do it. And I got really good at math. That's why I took that job. I didn't study math. I studied Native Studies and Science in middle years. But my first job was math job. And those questions, when you get into math 30, one question fills a whole blackboard. And so in order to be ready, I had to work really hard. And so that's why there was a cot there, because I put everything I had into it. And one of my favorite stories from that experience is I was with my level 30 students. I was going through this math question, full chalkboard math question, one question. This is what you do here, here, there we go. And we got to the end, it was wrong. So in the past, having the wrong answer would have broke my confidence, would have made me think I can't do it. But it was such a powerful, teachable moment to be able to erase and identify where I went wrong and then do it again. And then I got to tell my students, see, even teacher gets it wrong. The trick is to keep on trying.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about Rancherlo.
Rancherlo is an agency that works with youth. It's kind of like a group home program. So the kids are brought in from all over the country, from Newfoundland to Nunavut to the West Coast. And then they're brought here to be reintegrated into society, to be... sometimes it's behavior management. Sometimes it's they don't have a safe place to be. Sometimes it's trouble with the law or whatever it is. And so the focus really goes from like an academic first goal to confidence, value, goal. Like that has to be your goal, because you can't really teach somebody a math concept if they're not sure about whether or not they want to be here. You know, or whether or not they're worth learning, you know, or teaching. Or
that must have been an eye-opening experience working at Rancherlo.
It was eye-opening, but you know what? Where I come from, I didn't encounter anything that I hadn't seen before. It's part of our story of resilience and overcoming, is that you're born into sometimes traumatic, you know, settings and stuff. And over time, I've learned that the hardest parts of my life are the parts that have refined and built my character, and that if we want or if we fight, we can overcome. So.
And so how did the kids relate to you being an Indigenous male?
Well, that was my first in, because I was one of them. You know, like I said, when I was young, I was wild. I got in trouble with the law and stuff like that. And I've had experiences that are not great and all that. So the first in was that I was Indigenous, Métis. And the second in was that I could relate at a level that a lot of the other staff couldn't relate at. Because the clientele there are primarily Indigenous, almost exclusively Indigenous. And then the flip side is true for the staff, almost primarily non-Indigenous staff.
And what do you mean by an in?
Well, I was one of them. When I talked, I didn't have to put on a show. They knew that I was talking from a place of authentic experience, to know what it's like to be hungry, to know what it's like to be, have low confidence, low self-esteem, to feel abandoned, to feel not sure about my value, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I've had some really challenging experiences, but you know, when you flip the challenging experiences, that's what your greatest tools become. Right? The things that bring you maybe guilt and shame out here in the real world, in a place like that, become your greatest assets, because you can pull on that stuff and you can use it to relate and help other people, to relate with and help other people.
How did your experience at Rancherlo make you feel to see there was vulnerable youth like that?
It wasn't an eye-opener for me. I knew. We know. That there's in our communities, specifically in the North, like I'll speak about what I know. I've seen, you know, the dark side of alcohol and drug abuse and stuff like that. So it's not like it's something that's foreign, you know. If anything, I felt comfortable in that setting. because I was acquainted with that. I'm not just saying that it's my family, but my community. We know what it's like to be in that setting. So, again, those kind of experiences in my life are what equipped me to be able to help.
Do you have any moments in your time at Rancho Rolo that stick out with you the most?
Well, there's lots of them, but I think if I were to think about anything, I think the most meaningful thing to me was near the end of my career, I started pioneering the land-based education with my students. See, I was trained to be an educator. I really love public speaking. I feel like I'm an adequate communicator. I'm not a bad storyteller. All that, I'm a good teacher. When I retired, I felt like I was operating at still a high level. But I learned early on that when I went on the land, me with all my talents, all my skills, I'm not saying there's many, but me and everything that I have to offer is nothing compared to the effect that the land has on people. Me and all my eloquence, all my stuff can't even compare to what nature does automatically, how it soothes people. You see kids that struggle to be in a room with other kids become leaders on the land, become team members on the land, become chill, you know? It's a beautiful thing to witness. So that's probably, like, it still gives me goosebumps talking about it. So that's probably one of the most meaningful things, yeah.
Okay. So for those who don't know what land-based learning is, can you share with us what land-based learning is?
Well, for me, like, I'm not a pro by any means, but just being out on the land, identifying things about the land, whether it's like animal tracks or direction or traditional medicine or berries or harvesting. One thing I would do is we would just hike out on the land. In the wintertime was my favorite. In Labrette, there's a big hill up there. There's a church there. We would hike up that, turn it below, find a place to make a fire and just prepare a meal together. And through that struggle, like you won't know what it's like until you experience it. But when there's a little struggle involved, that's when the food tastes good. That's when the bonding happens through that struggle. And so just being out there in the first place is tremendous.
And how receptive were the kids to being out on the land?
Most of them were excited because we're innately connected, eh? And like I said, the majority of my students were indigenous. They were native. And so I didn't have to do much. Just say, we're going. Okay, we're going. Let's go. Let's see what we can find out there. And then just let it take place. You know, we come from a place of four walls and structure and planning. You go out on the land and then you become an observer, a witness to what's happening. You see an animal, well, you take the time to observe. Then you have a conversation about it. You have a gentle wind flowing that day, blowing that day. You sit down, take it in. Just have some peace. Pick up your gear. Let's go again.
What was that term you just used?
Kiapits. It means like some more. Yeah.
Some more?
Yeah.
Kiapits?
Kiapits, yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Okay. So after 14 years of teaching, you've decided to retire and you're now a tattoo artist. Can you share a little bit about that with me?
Well, it wasn't either this or that kind of decision. I taught and tattooed for 10 years. I was doing both. I had a private studio in my garage that I had built. I had kind of niched out this nice, really nice experience for my clients in a welcoming, casual environment. And I was just pulled, like, I never wanted to tattoo. I never considered myself an artist. I always considered myself an athlete. when I moved to Regina, I was boxing. I was having success with that. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an amateur boxer. I was well on my way to doing that. One day I was in a car accident and it just changed the whole course of my life. And I couldn't box anymore because I was hurt. I couldn't play sports anymore. And then that's when tattooing entered my story. And when that happened, it was like the river of my life forked. And from that point on, it was like I was creating and sacrificing so that I could make more room for tattooing. I got into Muay Thai. I had to quit Muay Thai because it was competing for my time. I was playing volleyball. I had to cut out volleyball because it was competing for my time. And then eventually it just got to the point where it's either tattooing or teaching, man. And I...
So have the arts always been in your blood? Were you always good at drawing and,
no,
and art and stuff?
No, I basically taught myself to tattoo. I had a mentor who was in L'Orange and we'd talk on the phone, scoured the internet for resources, YouTube. There wasn't many back then, 13 years ago. But I thought about that. I thought about how come tattooing does this thing for me. When I was in high school, I had a real love for poetry, but I was kind of a volatile kid and I had a reputation. I didn't want people to know I write poetry. So I had this like secret with my English teacher. He'd read my poetry and all that. Eh? I love words, you know, metaphors and stuff, yeah. Using abstract thought to paint stuff, you know? And then when I started thinking about that, I realized that poetry is the flip side of tattooing because I was using words to describe pictures when I was writing, but now I'm using pictures to describe words and concepts, nice. Right? So it's just in that way, I think I was an artist and I never really put myself out there as an artist until recently because I've embraced that now.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And who was your mentor in L'Orange?
His name was Bunt. Yeah. Yeah, Gary Little is his given name, but Bunt was his name. And he was like an older brother type for me. He was my tattoo artist. We built a really strong friendship over the years. And it was just this thing of, the guy never even pumped gas. He just tattooed his whole life. And he recognized something in me and he said, you should try this. But I was busy boxing. I said, bro, I'm not a tattooer. I can't even draw a stick, man. I want to box. But when I got hurt, I was put in a vulnerable enough position to consider something else. And then that's how tattooing came in.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And so what is something that Bunt has shared with you that has stuck with you to this day?
Quality over quantity. It's about people first. People. If you think about it, the philosophy that I've inherited is that we'll never get the time back. So why not make it the best time? Have the good music playing. Have good conversation. Treat your client with dignity and respect. And then at the end of the appointment, the tattoo is like a bonus because we just had an awesome hangout, you know? And that's how I felt with him. I had to pay him so that I could just hang out with him. I just wanted to hear his stories. And if I had to pay for a tattoo, I was willing to do it, you know? He's that kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And you and I met this past summer at Batosh.
We did, yeah.
Well, that was very enjoyable.
Very enjoyable.
I still got my Musqua on my forearm.
There you go.
Looking forward to getting some color on it here in the future.
Yeah.
Tell me what your experience was like at this year's Back to Batosh Days.
Well, that's kind of a loaded one because I experienced a lot of different emotions being there. I struggled with addiction for a really long time and I left the North 16 years ago. Excuse me. And I didn't realize how hard it was on me. I left a very, very close-knit family, a very close-knit extended family, and I moved away and I was the only one who left. And so when I got sober 2 years ago, it was like my spirit woke from a slumber and I started to really press into this tattoo style that I've like developed, this culturally specific stuff. And when I went to Batosh, that feeling of Wahkutoin, the kinship, the interconnection with my people was so strong there. Every experience, you know, and I don't want to talk in general terms, but a lot of the experiences, a lot of the conversations were just like pouring water on me. Like it was soothing to me to be back and to be welcomed and to be treated so generously and graciously by the people and communities that I love.
Good for you. Yeah. And congratulations, by the way, on your 2-year sobriety.
Thank you.
What's that journey been like?
Well, I've learned a lot. I just had a conversation with my former principal this morning about how, you know, it's only been 2 years that I've lived this life this way, a healthy life. I've always felt like there was a black cloud over me, and it was only a matter of time. If things were going good, it was only a matter of time before the wheels fell off or before I burned everything down to the ground. So I always felt like I was in this perpetual fight or flight, barely staying above water, just trying to survive. And then 2 years ago, I kind of had this experience where I was really confronted about some realities in my life. And my focus shifted from a victim reaction-based mentality to an assertive, more let's figure this out kind of mentality. I experienced some healing, and the healing is what enabled me to see more clearly, because I was seeing through shame and guilt and like a deficit mentality. And as I began to heal, the blinders came down and I began letting people in and I began asking for help. And it's been an unbelievable transformation. There's laughter in my home. There's joy in my home. My work's been in the Museum of Vancouver this year for an 8-month exhibition. I've been to Toronto 3 times. I've been in a podcast. I've been in all these interviews. I've been around speaking. I spoke to 200 teachers last year. Like, just unreal. Unreal. If I knew earlier that it was possible for me, I wish I could go back. But at the same time, like I said, we go through the challenging things so we can have more to offer when we get to the other side, right? Yeah,
I know what you mean. I'm on my 6-year journey of sobriety too, and it's been just an eye-opening experience being sober and you know, just enjoying life again.
Yeah,
because I too would have had a black cloud over my head for a lot of my years when I was on the bottle and whatnot.
For sure.
So let's back up to Batosh again. Tell me about your 4 days at Batosh.
Well, like, it was hot.
You shared a little bit. Yeah, I recall that vividly.
Boy, it was hot. I think I came home 10 pounds lighter, but no worry. I put it back on, bro. We're good. Yeah, it was hot. I don't know. You know, there's this principle you talk about, or we learn about. It's called natural law. When you open your eyes to things that, like I said, when you're on the land, things that aren't planned, you know, every person you meet, every conversation you have, you keep an open mind about what's going on. And then from a certain perspective, it feels like gifts. You get to meet this person. You get to bring this person into the tattoo world. You do their first tattoo. I met a lot of people. A lot of people were excited. One of the highlights is my sister was there. My sister, Billy Jo, who I greatly admire and love, got to spend that time with her. My colleague, one of my tattooing peers, Gina, was there. It was her first time at Batosh. It's interesting because when we left Regina, we didn't have everything. There was no guarantees about where we were going to stay. Stuff. There was a little bit of mix-up. We're on the road. We're in a truck. I turned to Gina and I said, you know what, G? I have a real strong sense that whatever need we have is going to be met. And we just went and met in spades. No need. Every need we had, met. From running out of supplies and then my boss being in Saskatoon saying, yeah, I'll bring them, you know, and like everything. M&S giving us a trailer with air conditioning was a huge, huge, you know, we didn't ask.
Yeah.
bro, you need air conditioning, you need a trailer. I said, yes, like next year. Now, I said, please. And then next thing you know, we got one. Yes, people bringing us meals, people bringing us water, drinks, checking in on us. And then, like I said, when I left there, I felt emotional because I was leaving that feeling that I grew up with to be connected to my people, you know? And then to go south, my people are here too. But it's just, it's home is there.
Yeah.
You know, and that feeling of wahkutuin. You're in the river with your people, you know. I got to tattoo Glenn McCollum, president. That was an unreal experience. CEO, Richard Quintel, that was unreal. Tattooed you. I had to say no a lot because I was so busy. But I'm really looking forward to doing it again.
Do you plan on returning to Batoche?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. No question.
It was, I was quite impressed watching you and Gina tattoo in 30 degree heat every day because it was plus 30 every day.
Yeah.
What was that like to just tattoo one person after another in that heat?
Well, there was highs and lows for sure because my favorite part of the day was when it got to evening because the main stage was open. We got the live music. It cooled down. Then I felt really, really happy. But through the day, the thing that kept me motivated, that thing that kept me my spirits up were the people, the conversation, the excitement, you know. Tattoos are powerful, powerful thing. It's not just ink and skin, you know. There's something ceremonial about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you essentially are building people, building up people, you know. On one hand, it can be closure. On one hand, it can be courage, identity. You know, it's a big deal. So regardless of the weather and stuff like that, I felt like what I was doing had purpose to it. And that was what helped me stay motivated.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And so you have a tattooing expo coming up here in Regina later this month. Can you share with me what that's about?
Well, we're calling it Wahkutuin Tattoo Gathering. And basically, I was out in Toronto in August. I took my parents. I invited them to come with me. It was my mom's birthday. We went out there for a week and we just had an unbelievable time. Some really cool stuff happened. I had a dream about a month before we went, and I woke up not remembering anything except for this phrase, cut your life in half. Cut your life in half. And basically the picture that I got that would illustrate that is I'm too busy. And if I'm too busy and I'm constantly looking at the work of my hands, then I can't see what's going on around. And I think that we need to have an allowance for spirit in our life. We need to have an allowance for natural law to happen in our lives. And when I went to Toronto, I'm usually really booked, solid, like wall-to-wall booked. And this trip, my clients were unable to keep their appointments. So then I thought, okay, well, I'll break even. It'll be fine. We have what we need. I'll just... rather than panicking and trying to find appointments, I just resigned to the fact that, you know, I don't know how many more trips like this I'll have with my parents. They're aging. I'll just have a great time with them. And I had forgotten that this guy asked me to be on a podcast, and I went and did that podcast, and the money that I would have made that I didn't make was in this check he gave me. He paid me so, like, lavishly that it was like reinforcing, bro, somebody's got you. I got you. So
what was that podcast about?
It was about my story and kind of like I am going to be launching a platform for public speaking presentations, inspirational type of presentations. And so I feel like my message has to do a lot with my journey. And I think the key component of my journey is reconciliation with myself, making peace with me, making peace with my story, where I come from. And that has empowered me to be able to reconcile with others, you know? And so I talked about that. I talked about tattooing. It was an electric podcast. It was amazing. I can't wait to hear it. Yeah. But that just kind of reinforced this idea of gratitude and this sense that I've had a second chance. When I came back from Toronto, I felt so grateful for that experience that I got an idea, man, I got to give something away. That's just how I am. How do we show that we're grateful? Well, you give. Right. Part of it was offering to creator, to maker, to say thank you for keeping me around. Thank you for giving me a second chance. But also to thank specifically the Métis frontline workers. That was my goal. I was going to do a little giveaway, but I've done giveaways and they don't always work because people can't get here or whatever the circumstances are. It's a small scale thing. Then I thought, well, I'll do a little event at the shop. Then I just got this thought, bro, man, think big. And if it scares you, that's where you should be. So I said, okay, I can think big. Don't want to get emotional. I said, okay, I'll think big. I'll tattoo 100 people. I'll tattoo 100 people for free. I'll ask if anybody wants to help me. That's what I'm going to do. I put it out there to the people. Boom. Do my tattoo bros? Yeah, we'll help you. We'll do it. We'll tattoo 100 Métis frontline workers for free. They don't have to do nothing. They don't have to. All they have to do is say, hey, I work in community. This is my job. This is my name. Can you put me on a list? Boom, you're on a list. 100 from physicians to professors, teachers, nurses, frontline, street level, everything. They're coming. We have 100 of them.
To the Wandering Métis?
Yes, to the Wandering Métis. You're right. Yeah. And so we're doing that November 17th. I reached out to a tattoo supply company, one of my acquaintances. I thought, man, I never even considered asking for help. I said, I'll just do it on my own. And then one of the guys said to me, well, it's kind of slow right now. I don't know if I can just give my supplies. So then I thought, well, why don't we ask for supplies? So I messaged this guy, told him the vision, told him a little history of the Métis people, why we're celebrating them. Half an hour later, he said, bro, I'm in. So now we have supplies. Reached out to M&S. They said, make a list, made a list. Now we have some money to make it work. And you wouldn't believe, person after person, entity after entity, we want to help. We want to help individual people. Can I volunteer? Can I bring donations? What can I do? It's been amazing.
That is amazing.
Yeah, so you can tell I just got fired up. I'm excited about it. And I think the whole basis of this thing is to celebrate our people, but also to unite our people. You know, we have this kind of legacy of, I don't know how you want to frame it, but if they don't like something, they won't come. Or if you're doing something like this, then they won't come. There's no ulterior agenda. It's just, let's be together, regardless of our differences. We can't let that separate us now. We have to break new trail and show that even if we disagree, we can still, at the bare minimum, be kind and respectful to each other. And that's what we're doing. So
good for you. And who are some of your colleagues that have stepped up to the plate? And
Gina will be there. And then we have another Métis artist. Her name is Stacey Fayant, celebrated artist here. And then we have about four or five of them from the shop I work at. And then just other people, some of my friends. So.
And where is this event taking place?
Midnight Oil. Midnight Oil, our shop in town. Yeah.
Okay. And where is the shop located?
2206 Dewdney Avenue, right on the Dewdney Strip. Upstairs, Bushwhackers, second floor. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. Before we wrap up, Nolan, I ask this of almost all my guests that I interview, whether it's video, whether it's podcast.
Yeah.
If you had some words of advice for a young Nolan Malbuff, what would your advice be to a young Nolan?
It's a tough one. I've just recently got to a place where it's okay to talk about young Nolan, but if I could tell him anything, I would just say, keep getting up, keep getting up. You know, I was a boxer and you can lose 11 and a half rounds and land one punch and you win. We all have that potential. Life can be hard and it can be cruel, but it can also be beautiful. And you'll never win if you quit. So you gotta just keep getting up. The clouds will break and the sun will shine.
Good for you. Well, thank you for joining me here today at the Métis Nation Saskatchewan Legislative Assembly, Nolan. It was kind of off the cuff, but you've done very well. So thank you again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I look forward to seeing you on the 17th, 16th and the 17th.
Me too. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.